Feature a model-based image segmentation using Monte Carlo VL.
Okay, that's a bit of false advertising. The program was incorrect. So if you want to see the talk about ambulance fleet management, you'll have to come back next week. But if I did also present this at BERS, so if you saw the same talk at in Banff, you officially have my permission to check your email or leave the room. This is joint work with a former student of mine and Ciprian Crainachanu, who's at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. We introduce a new technique for model-based image segmentation. Okay, it's specifically focused on capturing features in images that are quite small, such as tumors or lesions in a brain image. Okay, it turns out that current model-based approaches to image segmentation perform quite poorly in this particular situation. We apply our method to analyze dynamic contrast-enhanced magnetic resonance images, which are three-dimensional medical images gathered across time. Our method is a Monte Carlo EM approach. Like many of you, I'm not the biggest fan of expectation maximization. It does only give us a local maximum of the likelihood function, but these are such large-scale applications that we really found that a Markov chain Monte Carlo approach was too computationally intensive, and we had to go with something slightly simpler. Our particular contributions are to show how to incorporate weight parameters or probability parameters associated with the clusters into the spatial model-based segmentation approach in a computationally tractable way. People have included these parameters before and have used pseudo-likelihood or other approximations. It turns out that in these large-scale medical images, the algorithms can diverge because the pseudo-likelihood estimate is infinite. So we had to address this by using a more exact approach. In other words, using an approach that will converge to a local maximum of the likelihood function, which is finite in many situations in which the pseudo-likelihood estimate is infinite. I show that this is needed for capturing small features in the image, again, like tumors or lesions. I'll also incorporate a covariance decomposition. This is really helpful from a practical perspective to give control over the geometric characteristics of the segmentation. Okay, the motivation here, again, this medical imaging context. These dynamic contrast-enhanced images are obtained by injecting a subject with a contrast agent and then monitoring the diffusion of the agent into the tissue using a sequence of magnetic resonance images. This allows improved viewing of certain features, in particular lesions in the brain for multiple sclerosis subjects. These lesions are quite small relative to the volume of the brain, and that's why these existing methods really don't work well. I'll talk more about why existing approaches are ineffective for this context. Okay, so here's an example of one of these dynamic contrast enhanced. It's a series of MRI images over time. Okay, so the black outline here is the white matter, and that's the region of interest here. So don't try to ignore what's going on outside of the white matter. It's not really relevant. And really focus on what's happening inside. Okay, I'll show you once more. Okay, and you can see some things going on. In particular, you'll notice that there's a spot here that's dark initially, and as time goes by, it becomes bright. This is a multiple sclerosis lesion. Okay, what's happening is that the contrast agent, which is in the blood, diffuses across the brain-blood barrier, which is damaged in multiple sclerosis disease process, so that it creates these lesions. So they show up as bright spots on this image. Okay, so watching once more. Okay, you can also see some other things, such as the fact that the images, some of the images are brighter than others overall, and there are some other issues that are simply an artifact of the imaging process. We'll try to handle those as we do the analysis. Okay, so the goal, again, to try to do automatic segmentation of this region of interest, which is the white matter. So segmentations that look like this, for example. This is the result of our method. And you can see we've successfully pulled out the MS lesions as one segment, shown in red, and then we've also distinguished between different types of tissue within the brain. Okay, so just a little bit of notation. The data here are observations at every voxel in a two- or three-dimensional image. A voxel is the general term for a pixel. So if you think about a pixel in two-dimensional images, in a three-dimensional image, that would be called a voxel. So I'll refer to those as voxels throughout the talk. And at each voxel, we have a potentially multi-dimensional observation. So in a color image, this would be red, green, blue values, or you might think of the multiple channels in an MR image. Okay. The segmentation, of course, the goal is to assign to every voxel a group, which I'll call ZI, between one and some number, capital K, of groups, within which each of, and we need within each group the values should be relatively homogeneous, the observed values. Additionally, these group assignments shouldn't be too noisy across space, because we don't really believe that in human tissue, the type of tissue changes rapidly in space. So we want some kind of smoothness in space. Model-based clustering is a natural statistical approach to this problem, and it has the advantage of being quite easily extensible. We can extend it to multiple subjects, longitudinal data, and so on. So it's quite a flexible approach. Capital K, the number of groups here, or clusters, can be either fixed or learned from the data. Okay. So in my particular model, I'll assume that the observations are normally distributed conditional on the group assignment. You can replace this normal assumption with anything in the exponential family, although the covariance decomposition that I'll describe is only relevant for the normal distribution or the multivariate t-distribution. The group assignments are modeled using a Markov random field model. This will look familiar to many of you. Okay, so the prior on the group assignment vector, given a spatial interaction parameter and a vector of probability parameters, is proportional to the exponent of a term that captures the spatial smoothness and a term that captures the weights of the different clusters. Okay, here we have a summation over all pairs of voxels that are spatial neighbors. That can be defined in different ways. Okay. For our particular application, we take the 6 directly adjacent voxels. Sometimes people take the 8 voxels that are adjacent, including the diagonally adjacent voxels. We'll use the 6. Actually, it's more than 8, sorry. But in any case, we use the 6 directly adjacent voxels. So there's this term, again, this is a summation of the indicator that the observation that voxels I and j are in the same group. So this is the total number of adjacent pairs of voxels that are in the same group. So this is large when the cluster assignments are relatively spatially smooth. Okay, so this provides an incentive for that spatial smoothness that we want. And the second term just allows different clusters to be more common or less common. Now, the second term is almost always omitted from these Markov random field models for spatial analysis, for image segmentation. And I'll argue that we really do need this term, even though it causes a bit of a computational headache. And I'll explain how we address that. Okay, G here, just the normalization constant. Okay, notice that G is intractable to compute directly because it's a summation over an exponentially large number of configurations Z. Okay, the unknown parameters here are those associated with the groups, as well as our spatial interaction parameter and this vector of probabilities for each of the groups. Okay, so again, just emphasizing that this is a spatial interaction parameter. The bigger it is, the larger the amount of spatial association. When phi equals 0, we get a reduction to the standard IID normal mixture model. So, and this reduction only occurs if you include these parameters. So it is natural to include these parameters, but is typically omitted, again, in practice. And that's because this normalization constant depends both on phi and on the vector p. And now if you drop these parameters from the model, then this is a function of just one dimension. It's a lot easier to estimate numerically. With the parameters p, this is higher dimensional, and you can't simply pre-compute it on a grid of values effectively. So we'll need to do something a little bit more careful here. Okay, again, this term is going to be critical for capturing small features in the image. Again, it's been included previously by using approximations like the pseudo-likelihood and the mean field approximations, but we had a major problem, which is that these methods diverged for our images, and the reason being that the maximum pseudo-likelihood estimate of phi can be infinite in cases where the maximum likelihood estimate is finite. So we'll go instead for the approach of trying to get a local maximum of the likelihood function, which will work effectively for these images. Okay, there's a nice trick in our computational method, which is that instead of trying to directly estimate this normalization constant g, we'll instead estimate the derivatives, the gradient, and the Hessian of g, which is actually an easier problem than approximating g directly. Okay, I also want to mention this practical contribution that I talked about before, which is a restriction on the covariance matrices for the different groups. Remember that capital sigma sub k is the covariance matrix of the normal distribution for the kth group. And by making restrictions on sigma sub k, we can control the geometric characteristics of the clusters. So we can control which characteristics are common across clusters and which are allowed to vary. Okay, we use a spectral decomposition of the covariance matrix, and each of these values, lambda k, dk, and ak, have nice geometric interpretations. So lambda k really is the volume of the cluster in the d-dimensional space. D sub k is a matrix of eigenvectors, okay? Okay, so what's really going on here is that lambda k is controlling the volume of the kth cluster. Ak is controlling the shape. Is it circular? Is it ellipsoidal? And dk is determining the orientation of that ellipse. So then we can restrict some of these values to be common across the clusters and allow some of them to vary across the clusters, giving different types of segmentations. So for instance, if we take quite a strong restriction and set AK and DK to be the identity matrix, but allow lambda to vary, we would get spherical clusters that could be potentially of different sizes. Okay. So let's talk about the computational method. Again, this is a Monte Carlo EM approach. We will get a local maximum of the likelihood function. The parameters here are spatial parameter, our vector of probabilities, and then these cluster-specific parameters. This extends the method that was described in these two papers. Okay, those methods did not include the vector of probability parameters p or the covariance decomposition. Okay, like any EM approach, we need to run it from multiple starting points and take the final value of the parameters that gives the highest observed data likelihood. However, it's important to understand that the observed data likelihood cannot be computed in closed form in this example. Okay, so that we have to again approximate the observed data likelihood in order to compare these final values of the parameters, and we do that using a thermodynamic integration approach, which is, I won't describe in detail, it's closely related to what we'll talk about in the following slides. Thermodynamic integration is not my idea, okay, it's an existing approach. So just to break down the EM method a little bit, complete data log likelihood is the sum of two terms. The first term is capturing those normal distributions, okay, and the second term is capturing the prior on the cluster assignment Z. Okay, so in our E step, we're going to need to calculate the expectation of the complete data log likelihood. That means we need to calculate the expectation of these various terms, which can't be done in closed form. We'll need to use a Markov chain Monte Carlo approach to approximate those expectations. So when we do that, we need to use a Markov chain that's really designed for these Markov random field models, and we use Svensson Wong, which is quite efficient for these types of models. This gives us our Monte Carlo estimates for these various terms. Okay. So the next step in the EM is, of course, to maximize this expected complete data log likelihood. The updates for the cluster-specific parameters like mu and sigma is in closed form, so that's quite easy. And the interesting bit comes when we try to maximize over the spatial interaction parameter and this vector of probabilities. So this has to be done numerically. And G here is, again, is not available in closed form. So we take the approach of approximating the gradient and the Hessian of the term for the expected complete data log likelihood that includes these values. And we use a Newton-Raphson kind of iterative approach. The gradient and the Hessian are, again, approximated using Markov chain Monte Carlo. And we take advantage of the following property, which is that if we want the gradient and the Hessian of our normalizing constant, okay, that can be written as expectations with respect to the prior over z. Okay, so it's quite convenient that although we don't know the normalizing constant, again, if we take the derivative of log of g with respect to, say, phi, we get the expected value with respect to the prior of this sum of adjacent pairs of voxels that have the same, are in the same group. So we can calculate this using Markov chain Monte Carlo. Any questions? OK. So I want to talk about this DCE MRI application. We will focus on the white matter of a particular subject who has multiple sclerosis, the one that I showed before. There are 384,000 voxels in the white matter for this a DCE MRI study, so quite a large data set. And the measurements are at 60 time points for each of those voxels, right? So these 60 time points are over a period of 155 minutes. There's the agent was injected 2 minutes after the start of the sequence. Okay, these time points are unequally spaced, as I'll show on the next slide. So here, to illustrate the time series of the MR intensities at each voxel, I'm showing some of these time series. Okay, again, at the voxel level, picking out a particular voxel, look at the time, the MR intensity over those 60 time points. And I've given you two plots because I want to point out a particular fact, which is that many of the voxels behave in this way, namely that after you inject the contrast agent, really nothing happens over time. So it's fairly constant over time. We have this little bit of an up and then a down at the end. That's just an image, an artifact of the imaging process. Don't worry about it. Okay. But then you have other voxels that do something like this. After you inject the contrast agent, then the intensity of the voxel jumps. In other words, the voxel gets brighter on the image. Okay. And these roughly correspond to those MS lesions that we saw in the demonstration near the beginning. Okay, so before I do the clustering approach, I'll do a dimension reduction step to reduce the dimension from 60 dimensions at each voxel down to just 2. Okay, so I'll use dimension reduction using a principal components analysis approach. It's a regularized functional principal components analysis. So here are the first four principal component functions. So these are, again, functions over time. Okay, here's the 155 minutes. And the first principal component is really just capturing the overall intensity of that voxel, right? Some voxels are brighter than others on the image on average. And the second principal component is capturing a gradual increase in that contrast intensity and then a slow drop off. Okay, whereas the third principal component really is capturing a rapid increase at the beginning. Okay, don't worry about what happens here. That's really just due to the fact that eigenfunctions have to be orthogonal to one another. So, but this is really just capturing this rapid increase at the beginning. So the third principal component is capturing this rapid contrast enhancement of a voxel, whereas the second principal component is capturing a slower enhancement of the voxel. So the first principal component score is really not believed to be associated with the MS disease process, so we won't use it. We'll focus on those second and third principal component scores, which capture 73% of the remaining variability. So here's a scatter plot of those scores over all of the voxels in this person's white matter. Okay, so there's 380-some thousand points on this plot. And this long tail roughly corresponds to these multiple sclerosis lesions, which enhance after you inject the contrast agent. Okay, so one thing that our clustering approach is going to cut up this space into different clusters or segments, and it definitely should pick this out as being a separate segment if it's going to be medically useful for us. Okay, I'll start by just applying some very simple approaches. The first approach is to apply an IID normal mixture model. So not our model, this is the non-spatial approach, just to see what happens. Here I've used three components for illustration. And so here are the cluster assignments indicated by color for each of the voxels. And we can see that there are some issues with this. From a medical perspective, this is very difficult to interpret. First of all, this long tail that really contains the MS lesions is grouped together with voxels that have very different properties. So it's grouped together with voxels that have quite low values of the slow enhancement and the rapid enhancement over here, the PC1 and PC2. And what that means is that when you look at the segmentation, and here I have just a two-dimensional slice of the segmentation, remember the segmentation is actually of a three-dimensional image, that this spot, which is definitely an MS lesion, is grouped together with this spot, which is most certainly not an MS lesion. So you get some strange effects in the segmentation. Additionally, this is hard to interpret because the means of all of these clusters are the same. Okay, so it's hard to say then what these different clusters represent because they have quite similar means. So if we use that geometric approach that I described before, where we put a restriction on the covariance matrices, that really helps here. So we will put a restriction on the volumes of the different clusters. So we'll rule out what's going on here, which is that we have one cluster that's simply the outliers in every direction. Okay, we're going to rule that out by saying that all of the clusters have to be of the same volume. They have to take up roughly the same space in this two-dimensional space, right? And so here's what happens when you put that restriction. You really then, now you distinguish the tail from everything else, so that's good from our perspective for this application. And you can see that the MS lesion has really been pulled out as being distinct from the rest of the tissue. But then we still have an interpretation issue because you'll notice that one of these clusters is non-contiguous in R2. So then from a medical perspective, it's hard to explain what this cluster represents. It's really two separate groups here. Okay. So let's try a spatial approach. The spatial approach will enforce some kind of spatial coherence of these segments and hopefully give us a more interpretable result. So here I've applied not our method, but the existing method, okay, by the Zhang and co-authors. This does not include those cluster weight parameters that I described. Okay, and you'll see that what happens is that the method really can't capture the tail separately from the rest of the points. Okay, the reason being that this tail has a very, very small proportion of the points in the data set. Although it's quite distinct, in this image, or in this scatter plot, excuse me, it only takes up less, it's less than a third of a percent of the points in the data set. Okay? So the method, because it doesn't have weights associated with the clusters, can't capture the fact that some clusters are more common than others. So it makes this cluster quite large, and what ends up happening is the segmentation is really meaningless for us. The MS lesions are grouped together with a bunch of other tissue. Okay, so this approach, although it gives us a nice spatially smooth segmentation, doesn't capture small clusters effectively. Okay, here's the results of our method. It really does pick out this group as being a separate group and then makes some reasonable distinction with the rest of the points. Okay, so it says it makes a cluster for all of the points that have low values of PC2 and PC3, for instance. And here's the segmentation that's associated with it. It does something reasonable. At the front of the brain, we have one type of tissue, and near the back of the brain, we have a different type of tissue. Okay, but here I used three clusters. That was arbitrary, so maybe we want to think a little bit more carefully about how many clusters we're using. So here, okay, so one could use some kind of objective criterion for selecting, the numeric criterion for selecting the number of clusters, such as an information criterion or a posterior probability. It turns out that in applications with such huge data sets like this one, you end up estimating a very large number of clusters. And from a medical perspective, again, that's not very informative. So trying to tell the doctors that you have 20 different tissue types and then to try to explain to them what all these different tissue types mean is difficult, okay? That result is not very useful. So we take the approach of looking at the results for different values of the number of clusters and then picking one or two values of K that give us really useful results from a medical perspective. Just I think a more practical approach to selecting the number of clusters. So here are the values of k equals 2 up to k equals 6. And I would argue that k equals 2 really isn't capturing some of the important features in the image. It's not distinguishing the lesions from everything else, for instance. So we need more than 2. But if we get up to k equals 5 or k equals 6, then we start making some very small distinctions between groups. So it'd be difficult to explain the difference between what this purple cluster means and what this light blue cluster means, for instance. So really, I think k equals 3 or k equals 4 are the most useful values for us. And here I'm showing the results for k equals 4 from our method. And you can see that, again, we're pulling out the MS lesions as being one group, and then we're making some distinctions between the principal component scores for the rest of the voxels. Here's the segmentation that's associated with it. And you can see that we have one segment that's really closer to the front of the brain. The dark blue segment is close to the back of the brain. And then there's a light blue segment in between. This could be due to a number of different reasons. One is that it could be due to spatial heterogeneity in the brain tissue. It could also just be an artifact of the imaging process, because with these MR images, you do have spatial heterogeneity of the image intensity and of the time signal of the image intensity. So this could be an artifact. This distinction between these three groups could just be an artifact of our imaging process. I've shown it to some doctors, and they think that these different segments probably are not associated with the multiple sclerosis disease process. Okay, so to conclude, we've introduced a method for model-based clustering used for image analysis. This method is particularly focused on accurately distinguishing small features in the image. We showed, there were some simulations I didn't have a chance to show you, that our method works far better than existing methods for distinguishing these small features. And we applied this to dynamic contrast enhanced magnetic resonance imaging. There's a preprint available on my website. Thanks.
Questions?
May I have misunderstood, but was the spatial contiguity in the principal component space?
No,
your clusters were not spatially contiguous in the brain. They were spatially contiguous in your principal component, which
in the principal component space.
So why would you believe spatially contiguous clusters within principal components as opposed to in the brain?
Okay, it's simply a matter of interpretation. So as you try to explain, we don't provide any. In the model, there's no incentive for the model to create something that's spatially contiguous in the principal component space. Okay, it just so happens that our results do give something that's spatially contiguous in this principal component space. So you're referring to, let me just go back.
I mean that one.
This plot on the left.
You've got the dark blue surrounding your red, which was
right. So the spatial term in the model is in this space, not in this space. Okay, that's important. Thank you. And you do have, sure, so it's not spatially contiguous in this space, that's true. But that's not actually completely desirable because you have, if you have two multiple sclerosis regions, lesions, they'll be spatially non-contiguous, right? But they are the same type of tissue. However, if you have something, my argument was simply that if we look at this image, it's difficult to explain to a doctor what this blue tissue represents. Okay, it doesn't always have low values of both principal component scores. Sometimes it does, but sometimes it has moderate values of both principal component scores. So then it's just difficult to explain. That's all. Yes.
Coming back to that, I'm getting slightly confused. The spatial contiguity is on the brain space.
Is on the brain space, right. Definitely.
It seems to be that you are interested indeed in very small region, and there's no reason to assume that the strength of the autocorrelation, you know, the phi would be the same for the red region, the green region, or the blue region. You know, I mean, you've got this phi parameter, which is mm-hmm. the same, but you've got a lot of heterogeneity.
Okay.
Would it be extendable? Do you think that
you certainly can extend this method to allow a different phi for each group?
Yes.
You would have that the. So the g function would be a function of a few more parameters, but I don't see any reason why it would complicate estimation. Since we're doing estimation of the Hessian and the gradient of G online anyway, and not trying to pre-compute it, having a few extra parameters, I'd have to think about it carefully, but I don't think that it would be a problem. Yes?
In calculating the derivative of the normalizing constant in the maximization state.
Yes.
How long does it take? Because the number of points is large, I guess. And you need fresh samples from the prior of Z given a particular data point.
Right. So I run so this is done using Markov chain Monte Carlo. That's how that estimate is obtained. So just to go back, you're talking about this calculation. So that's done using Markov chain Monte Carlo. I don't run the Markov chain for something like 10,000 iterations because as you're referring to, each iteration of the Markov chain is fairly expensive because we have 400,000 samples. However, it turns out that in order to get pretty good accuracy on this, we calculate an estimated standard error for this quantity, and we're able to get away with a much smaller number of samples, like 1,000 samples, and still get a standard error that's quite small on this expectation.
And do you have a good initial starting point for that?
Let's see. I don't remember precisely how we initialized this Markov chain. I think we just randomly assign each cluster, each voxel to a group. It seems to work. It works surprisingly effectively. The Svensson-Wong algorithm is pretty efficient for sampling from this type of model, particularly from the prior distribution. It's even more effective for sampling from the prior than it is from sampling from the posterior because it's specifically designed to sample from Markov random field models just like this prior.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.